finding great candidates to hire can be like, well, trying to find a needle in a haystack. Sure, you can post your job to some job board, but then all you can do is hope the right person comes along. Which is why you should try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you. It finds them for you. Its powerful technology identifies people with the right experience and actively invites them to apply to your job. You get qualified candidates fast. So while other companies might deliver a lot of hay, ZipRecruiter finds you what you're looking for. The needle in the haystack.
See why 4 out of 5 employers who post a job on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free, at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. That's ZipRecruiter.com/zip. ZipRecruiter.com/zip.
Sharks and lobsters, such Massachusetts summer topics.
Yeah, but these sharks aren't at the beach and the lobsters don't come with a bib.
What do you know about lobster bibs? You're from the West Coast. Lobsters out there don't even have claws.
Hey, I've been to your neck of the woods. I've had lobster once.
Yeah, sure you have. All right, I almost forgot to say hi to everyone. Okay, last episode we let you off easy with only a 15-minute long tale, and today we'll be on the short side too, I think.
Okay, well, let's get into Operation Lobster.
The lobster has to wait until we answer a question.
Okay, so David asked, would Whitey, Howie Winter, and C.B. Fleming have been aware of the loan shark case since it involved Jimmy Modarano and Brian Halloran, who were also Winter Hill members?
I would certainly say so, and you know I'm so cynical that I suspect Whitey fed them the cases.
Hey, you're not going to get an argument from me. Okay, now it's lobster time, and I think now is the perfect time to dig deeper into Special Agent John Zip Connolly.
I know you spent the last 2 weeks down a Zip rabbit hole.
Hey, too many hours not to share. So Connolly's parents were born in the same village in County Galway, Ireland. John Connolly Sr. came to the U.S. as a baby and grew up in South Boston. He got a job with Gillette and spent the next 50 years there. Connolly's mom, Bridget Kelly, didn't arrive in the States until 1929, where she got a job working in Washington, D.C., in the home of prominent attorney Walter Bruce Howe. John Sr. and Bridget married in about 1937 and were living in the Old Harbor Housing Project when John Jr. was born in August of 1940. The Connollys and the Balders were among the first inhabitants of the 1,000 residence project that had been completed in 1938. John McCormick had campaigned heavily for the development, which cost $6 million to build. It was later renamed for his mother. According to Connolly's own later statements, he hero-worshipped both the Bulger boys. Billy was 6 years older and book smart, while Whitey was 11 years older and street smart. Whitey was picked up in May of 1948 on assault charges, but released on bail, and nothing seems to have come of the charges. Sometime the following year, Connolly recalled Whitey appearing and offering ice cream to the neighborhood kids, saying he only accepted after 19-year-old Whitey coaxed him into agreeing. Months passed and Whitey appeared again, this time saving Connolly from a battle over a ball.
It's such a heartwarming story.
Hey, I have to remind you that you're not supposed to be swearing, but you're also not supposed to be keeping, you're also supposed to be keeping your snarkiness in check.
It's like eating boneless skinless chicken breast. Dry, boring, and beyond uninteresting.
Hey, I'm waiting for you to snap while we're recording and you go on one of your tirades that you don't even take a breath.
It's coming, trust me.
Okay, well, while we wait, let me continue my Zip bio. In 1952, the Connolly family moved to City Point and Junior attended Columbus High School. He followed in his hero Billy Bulger's footsteps and attended Boston College, where he graduated with a degree in government in 1964. The following November, Connolly's mother, Bridget, passed away.
Did Connolly serve in the military?
No, he somehow managed to avoid the Vietnam draft and instead took law classes at Suffolk while working as a teacher at South Boston and Dorchester High Schools.
It's nice to have connections. With the guidance of Billy Bulger, Connolly was determined to become a Fed. Thanks to where he grew up, he had more than the Bulgers for connections. John W. McCormick, the first Catholic and the longest sitting Speaker of the House. When he retired, he had served in the House for a while. Total of 42 years and 58 days, making him the 18th longest serving member. The housing projects that were built in McCormick's old neighborhood was named after his mother, as you mentioned before, and that was where Connolly grew up. McCormick and Connolly's father were both members of the Knights of Columbus, and when the time came, McCormick didn't just write a letter of recommendation for Zip, he wrote directly to J. Edgar Hoover.
In August of 1968, McCormick wrote the first letter, followed by a second letter in October, to which Hoover replied, quote, "I am pleased to inform you that Mr. John J. Connolly Jr., in whom you have expressed an interest, has been tendered an appointment as a special agent in the Federal Bureau of Investigation," unquote. Connolly had followed in his father's footsteps and joined the Knights of Columbus while attending BC. He had also made contact with fellow Knights of Columbus member Dennis Condon and BPD Detective Ed Walsh. Both men would later take credit for encouraging Connolly to go into law enforcement. Hoover received another letter from the Boston Sac a few days later, also recommending Connolly to the FBI at the behest of Dennis Condon.
Connolly began his FBI career in the Baltimore field office, followed by San Francisco, before being transferred to New York City.
I just want to point out here that this was not a typical FBI career track at that time. Many special agents were assigned to one office their entire career, like Dennis Condon and many of the other men in the Boston office that we have profiled in previous episodes. Others might train in one office and then transfer to their second office after a few years, where they would spend the remainder of their careers. But Connolly transferred 4 times in 3 years.
And he wanted to return to Boston to be closer to his ailing father,
who didn't pass until 1983. Longtime listeners will recall that 2 decades earlier, Special Agent H. Paul Rico also got a transfer back to Boston on account of his own ailing father.
But while Connolly was still in New York, he and 2 other agents apprehended Frankie Salemi in New York City in December of 1972. And for anyone who didn't listen to our episode about Frankie, definitely check that out, please.
With the help of Dennis Condon, and the link to that episode will be in the show notes. Connolly was recommended to receive a group reward for his part in finding Salemi in NYC, and just 2 months later, the FBI transferred Connolly to its Boston field office in the JFK building. During his 2002 deposition, former Special Agent Dennis Condon was asked if he had discussed the Barboza case with Connolly when they met in San Francisco. Condon stated that he could not recall any specific conversations, but he noted that Connolly had gone to meet Barboza at least once, although I suspect it was more like once a week. Condon would have needed someone he could count on to babysit Barboza.
Definitely a babysitting project. And do we get to plug our Joe Meet Joe episode here?
Of course, and ask our listeners to share episodes with their friends.
I think you just did. Okay, back to Boston. Connolly officially reopened Bulger as an informant on September 18th, 1975. He had previously been closed on September 10th, 1971 by Condon after just 4 months. And I'm sorry, but that's just like all crap on paper in my mind.
Okay. According to the later indictment against Connolly, he accepted a diamond ring from Whitey and Stevie Fleming in June of 76. Okay, that leads us to 1977. As we mentioned in the previous episode, Dennis Condon retired from the FBI in May of that year, and Ted Harrington was sworn in as U.S. Attorney for Massachusetts in August. He had been selected for the position by Senator Teddy Kennedy and appointed by President Carter.
Why did you have to bring up Carter? All I have is like visions of gas rationing. We had that stupid system based on the last number of your license plate, odd numbers on one day, even numbers on the other day. You had to sleep in your car in a line just to be able to get gas. And that's when the locking gas caps came, because if you were sitting in your house or you were sleeping or whatever, somebody would come with a straw or a hose or whatever they were coming with and siphoning off your gas.
Hey, I remember asking my parents as a kid why some of the older cars had the locks on the gas tanks, but let's save that time for another series.
Fine. In 1977, the FBI and the Mass State Police began cooperating on a joint operation investigating widespread truck hijacking in the commercial trucking industry in New England, and the target of the operation was the Winter Hill Gang.
FBI Special Agent Nick Gianturco, who had only just been recently assigned to the Boston office, went undercover posing as a fence. His direct supervisor was John Morris, who had been transferred to the Boston office in March of 72, exactly 1 year before Connolly's return. Morris was put in charge of the organized crime squad at the FBI's Boston field office in December of 77.
77 was such a magical year.
Okay. I want to delve a bit into Jan Turco's background. His father, Nicholas Sr., was born and raised in New York City, went to med school in Massachusetts, and started a practice in Chelsea in 1937. Nick graduated from BC a year behind Connolly with a degree in economics. Upon graduation, unlike Connolly, he served in Vietnam. Both Nick and his brother Charles went into the FBI and worked in the NYC field office. It would be 9 years before Nick would be sent back home to Boston for the undercover role as Nick Chiaro of Operation Lobster. He would pose as a fence operating out of a warehouse in the Reedville section of Hyde Park.
One of his compatriots in New York City was Joe Pistone, who he himself had gone undercover in 1976 as Donnie Brasco. Pistone was considered a pioneer in long-term undercover work. It's interesting that the FBI didn't start sending agents into those situations until after Hoover passed away in 1972. Hoover was opposed to the practice of his men going undercover as he saw the risk of corruption very clearly.
Well, that and the potential for entrapment.
Well, hasn't that become a tradition?
Thank you. Now, I know this seems like it's a bit off topic, but it's not. So two things connect here. First, Pistone's initial mission was intended to be the same as Jan Turco's in Boston, truck hijackings. But whereas Pistone's role expanded as he got in deeper with the Bonanno family dynamics, Jan Turco's mission was cut dramatically short thanks to Zip Connolly's machinations.
Well, he had to keep his boys on the street.
Indeed. And secondly, sometime after Pistone wrapped up his role as Donnie Brasco, he and the New York City assistant special agent in charge attended a dinner at Nick's home in Massachusetts where they met Whitey and Stevie. The ASAC, Jules Bonavolanta, later testified that he thought that he was aware of the fact that Bulger and Fleming were informants when he was introduced to them.
It's more magic. Now, with all of that out of the way, can we actually get to Operation Lobster?
Okay. The truck hijackings were nothing new. By 1969, it was reportedly a billion-dollar industry in the U.S., and that's 1969 dollars. We've covered a few incidents in previous episodes, everything from Carter's underwear to cigarettes and alcohol. And of course, longtime listeners will recall that Buddy McLean and his crew were active in the hijackings, as were the McLaughlins and their Charlestown gang.
I have fond memories of items from truck hijackings. What were those things? The Spydell watches, Planner's cheese ball puffs, and those racetrack things from Mattel. That was all in the 70s. Anyhow, in October of 1972, four men were arrested in Medford after hijacking a truck from Braintree. Ironically, the truck contained $200,000 worth of Gillette products, the very same company that Connolly's father was a longtime employee of. Two of the suspects were from Charlestown, Patrick McGonigal and his brother-in-law, Chester Ferreira.
The investigation continued throughout 78 and into 79. At the end of the first quarter of 78, John Morris's performance review noted, quote, he is imaginative, innovative, and extremely industrious, and has no hesitation in tackling major projects or complicated, which place a heavy demand on his time, often to the detriment of his family. Special Agent Morris possesses all the necessary attributes to be an outstanding bureau executive, unquote.
They left out the corrupt part.
Hey, wasn't that one of the necessary attributes?
That's true. This is true. All right. Let's not get ourselves into trouble, though. So moving on. In December of 1977, Special Agent Jan Turco got wind of a plot to hijack a load of film shortly after it left the Polaroid plant in Norwood while on its way to New Jersey. The plan was to somehow kidnap both the driver of the truck and the security guard following in an unmarked vehicle. The plotters would then bring the $1 million worth of product to Jan Turco to fence. But the FBI wasn't sure which Polaroid plant along Route 128, because I think there was 48 or 28, I can't remember, that was along that route. And then they would go from there to Norwood. Anyhow, Polaroid's procedure was to have one security guard come up from New Jersey, then promptly turn around and follow the truck back. The guard would fill his tank at a local service station, a mobile on the Providence Highway, before heading to the plant in Norwood to guide the delivery back to New Jersey.
So the plan that Pat McGonigal and his crew came up with was to kidnap the guard when he went to fill up at the gas station and place someone from their gang in the car who would then aid in the acquisition of the loot. The feds showed up at the service station on the Providence Highway at 1 in the morning on March 16, 1978. They allowed the overnight station attendant, 60-year-old Michael Rendini, to be kidnapped. The feds claim that they kept an eye on the kidnapped victim and were never going to allow him to be harmed, but they didn't make it in time to pick him up, and Rendini had to hitchhike back to work.
And we know you're not a local because you refuse to say Route 1 and want to call it the Providence Highway. And poor Rendini. In addition to allowing the kidnapping, the feds allowed the million-dollar heist to go down, but collected evidence that was later used in the arrests of McGonagall and his gang in March of the following year.
In the meantime, Billy Bulger had been elected president of the Massachusetts State Senate back in July of 78. He was hand-chosen by outgoing State Senate President Kevin Harrington, and the decision was praised by Governor Dukakis. The following month, Dennis Condon replaced John Kehoe as Commissioner of Public Safety. Governor Dukakis stated that choosing between Condon and State Police Major John Regan had been a difficult one. He praised Condon as someone who had, quote, great respect within the law enforcement community and a capacity for leadership that is extraordinary, unquote. Fast forward to January of 79, when Special Agents Connolly and Morris went to Assistant U.S. Attorney Jeremiah O'Sullivan and told him that Whitey and Stevie were actively informing.
And more magic, 2 months later, Operation Lobster suddenly came to an end.
The reason, according to Connolly, was that Whitey had told him that they were planning on robbing a fence who turned out to be Special Agent Nick Gianturco. In an effort to save his colleague's life, Connolly contacted Gianturco and told him that he was in danger, and they pulled the plug on the sting.
And everything secret degenerates. Mass State Trooper Bob Lang testified that Nick's life was never in danger. Stevie Fleming also stated that they just planned to rob Nick and not kill him.
Yeah, they were so trigger happy, though. I mean, how can you know that?
I wouldn't say that they were trigger happy. They were ruthless, and they didn't have much regard for human life. But think about the things they pulled off. They weren't, you know, running around and killing people in commission of a robbery. They were just killing people.
Okay. I'll concede the point.
Okay.
Anyway, later, Gianturco claimed that he never made the meeting because he didn't feel right about it, and that he only learned later from Connolly that McGonagall was planning to kill him after the fact. In addition, Connolly never filed a report of the alleged interaction with Bulger until 2 years later when he was trying to justify Whitey's continued usefulness to him as an informant. And instead of pointing out that Whitey would have been the perpetrator of the crime, Connolly said that Bulger had helped save an FBI agent's life.
Another heartwarming tale. Okay, moving on. In February of 1979, Johnny Maturano took it on the lam after Whitey and Stevie warned him of the coming indictments in the race-fixing case.
Hey, no more race-fixing discussion, please. We already did that episode.
Relax. But another one of the race guys, Barnowski, also went on the lam. And good old Jimmy Sims and Joe Mack were already laying low thanks to their earlier charges stemming from a variety of robberies and homicides.
Finally, in the following month, on March 15th, Operation Lobster was made public with the indictments of 46 people. And I just want to say here, beware the Ides of March.
Well,
at first, the authorities did not make it known to the public that an undercover FBI agent had been inserted into the truck hijacking ring, but rather referred to him as a federal spy.
Your favorite former Fed, Dennis Condon, who was by then the Mass State Police Commissioner, issued a statement that the operation utilized undercover operatives posing as brokers of bulk merchandise, both legit and taut, while posing as legitimate businessmen.
How lucky for Condon that he was able to take credit for the semi-successful operation. Then more Massachusetts magic when Jeremiah O'Sullivan was promoted to chief attorney of the New England Organized Crime Strike Force just 2 days after the indictments. The promotion gave O'Sullivan the job of prosecuting the case that the FBI had delivered to him.
On March 22nd, the Boston Globe reported that law enforcement were expanding their investigation to look at the Teamsters' involvement in the hijacking ring, saying that some union leaders may have at least sanctioned the thefts. Meanwhile, the indicted men had shirts made declaring, "Charlestown Lobsters, we are number one."
Hey, we need some merch with that on it. I bet our listeners would love it.
And we have to add that to our other lobster merch.
Yes. Okay, less than 2 weeks later, after Operation Lobster ended, Connolly told Gianturco that he had a few guys who wanted to meet him. Connolly brought Bulger and Flemmy to Gianturco's residence, where Gianturco prepared an Italian dinner and they discussed the case.
Gianturco later said that he felt comfortable discussing the case with them because Connolly had made the entree.
Hey, I wonder if they had pasta.
Whatever it was, I'm sure it was delicious.
I bet. McGonagall and his crew were sentenced in July of 79 for the Polaroid heist. The Charlestown gang included twin brothers Neil and James McLaughlin, no relation to our McLaughlins. They had been born in England, but their parents were from County Donegal. James Sheehan of Milton was also sentenced to 5 years in prison for his role in the heist.
With the convictions behind them and their golden boys, Whitey and Stevie, unscathed, the Boston Sac sent a memo to the FBI Director William H. Webster. Quote, Operation Lobster has been broadly acclaimed as one of the most successful law enforcement endeavors in the history of the Boston area. The SAC also noted that Supervisor Morris directed and provided leadership to several agents on his squad in bringing to a successful conclusion a bust-out case, an East Coast horse race-fixing scheme, sorry, I had to bring it up again, and the indictment of several subjects under the RICO statute for local burglaries and drug dealing. All of these cases received considerable notoriety in the Boston area and were of significant impact against organized crime in the Boston area, end quote.
No, let's wrap it up.
Next episode is one of your favorite genres.
And our listeners, I think, a hit parade episode. Thank goodness for that. Bye.